Before Paris runways and Zara halls, there was Dhaka muslin. So fine that it slipped through rings. And then it vanished. British policies didn't just kill industries, they crushed the soul of India's creativity. This is a story of creators who were cancelled long before cancel culture existed. Pride and craft. Once India's lifeblood, reduced to ashes by empire's ruthless hand. The industries that built a nation systematically dismantled. He's here to reveal that price.
Hello, Mr.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you too. How are you today?
Don't ask. I'll survive.
Three, two, one, action.
From the corridors, the UN, to halls of the parliament, he has made colonial reckoning impossible to ignore. The very eloquent Dr. Shashi Tharoor. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
Shashi, now there are talks about how Indian industries are facing pressure because of President Trump's tariff threats. It echoes what we've seen in the past with respect to industries in colonial times. What I want to ask you is, the British, they didn't just loot India's wealth. They destroyed India's industries as well, didn't they?
It's a long story. Even tariffs are part of the story, actually, because as we were talking yesterday, the British came in essentially as a trading company buying the very famous Indian cottons, muslins, linens, and so on, and selling them back home and making lots of money because they sold them for several times what they had to pay for it in India. But then as they acquired more power with the decline of Indian authorities and the increasing strength of the British on the ground and their right to collect revenue in the province of Bengal, which was the beginning of the whole adventure, they started extracting their profits at the point of a gun. So it was no longer a question of paying the price that the weavers wanted. The British dictated the price at the point of a gun. They no longer had to bring money from England to pay for it. They decided instead to actually extract the revenues from the locals and then spend those at a far lower price in buying these textiles and so on. And then what they did was they came up with tariffs. So what happened was that the old Indian exports to the rest of the world, when they went to Britain, they were suddenly taxed 70, 80, up to 100% of tariffs. On top of that, the British, once their mills started functioning and producing machine-made cloth in larger quantities and, of course, with a more systematic finish because it was machines doing it, they started sending these to India with no tariffs because they controlled the ports. So the result, of course, was that tariffs worked entirely against Indian industry. If you were to look at the whole story of the de-industrialization of India, it began in many ways under the British rule and with particularly textiles as a case study, because they did all of this. There are lurid tales which some believe or don't believe. There's a Dutch writer in the 1770s who talks about how British soldiers actually broke the looms and broke the thumbs of the weavers so they couldn't weave and so on. But what is undoubtedly clear, whether that story is true or not, the British claim the Dutchman was biased, and so we can go back and forth as to who or what is telling the truth. Certainly in oral legend, many Indians believe it to be a true story. But even apart from that, you saw statistics will confirm how things declined. Finished cloth. India had 25% of the world textile export market when the British came. It came down to 2% by the time the British left. India used to manufacture cloth by handloom weavers and sell it to the rest of the world. The Indians have been exporting fine textiles going back a couple of thousand years, in fact, more than that probably, because there's evidence of Indian cloth even in the ancient pyramids of Egypt. So you could go back 6,000 years for all we know. But I can tell you that the cloth was of such high quality that there were debates in the Roman Senate. The historian Pliny the Elder records Roman senators declaiming against the Roman women because all the gold in Rome, they said, was sitting in India because of the taste of Roman women for these fine muslins and cloths and robes. You also had the muslins coming particularly out of Bengal, which were light as woven air, it was said. Some that were so fine you could pull them through a ring. I mean, that's the kind of quality that India was famous for. I've recounted in my book, Inglorious Empire, about how British shopkeepers used to get into trouble for trying to pass off shoddy European-made cloth as made in India because made in India had so much more prestige and commanded such higher prices. The British systematically, as I said, as I described already, reduced that, but then they converted India instead into an exporter of raw cotton. And they, in turn, exported the finished cloth to India. If you just look at, say, between roughly 1820 and 1870, you see a dramatic increase in the amount of cotton that is being shipped from India to England, raw cotton, from just, say, 10,000 bales to a million bales by 1870. And you see an even greater increase in the export of finished cloth from England to India, a modest amount in the 1820s, to a billion yards of cotton, finished cotton cloth in 1870. So there is absolutely statistical evidence in favor of all of this. The result of all of this was even more complicated because what happened was these weavers essentially were done out of their livelihood and they had to leave. In fact, some of the first towns in the history of urbanization to lose population were Dhaka and Murshidabad, which were major centers of weaving, because people had no longer any ability to live in those cities. They had no means of income. They had no work anymore. And they left Dhaka and Murshidabad, and they ended up, unfortunately, carrying on into the rural areas, which couldn't support them. Complications, therefore, was the creation of landless labor, the situation where, unfortunately, these weavers flocked into the countryside, didn't have any work there either, certainly didn't own any land because they used to be weavers, couldn't practice their professions. It was a human tragedy as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a question that people have on the internet asking us, Shashi, that Britain's famous textile revolution, did it really begin with the invention of the power looms, or was it actually powered by putting crazy tariffs on India's superior cloth?
No, both. I mean, there was no question that, of course, they decided that they couldn't compete with the quality of Indian hand weaves in the beginning, and so they did all the things I've described to you. But the power loom certainly helped, and there were other inventions, the water frame loom and so on and so forth, Arkwright. One interesting thing is the British often, in defense of what I've just been arguing, they say, oh, it's not our fault. India fell behind because you missed the bus for the Industrial Revolution. My answer is, we missed the bus, it's because you threw us under its wheels. We didn't have a chance. Had India been a free country, number one, we wouldn't have had the British dictating terms of tariffs on our ports. Yes, they could have raised tariffs on their side, but they couldn't have brought their stuff to India without tariffs to begin with. Second, whatever India produced, they couldn't impose excise on them, which they did. Third, these products, these textiles, when they actually were started to be manufactured more cheaply, more efficiently on machines, a free India could have bought those machines too and retrained its workers to manufacture, because the tradition of textiles, the export markets, the customers, all exist for centuries. All you have to do is change the method of production. And in a free country, you could have done that. Because you were a colonized country, you couldn't, because they wanted to sell their goods, so they prevented you from creating yours. It was right into as late as the 1890s that India finally started developing textile mills of its own, I think. Finally, something like, I think in the 1890s, about 9% of the cotton sold in India was actually manufactured in India. Otherwise, it was all being imported from England. That's what led to the so-called Swadeshi movement, when a lot of nationalists said, why are we complicit in our own oppression by buying the British cloth? Let us boycott British-made cloth.
You have such a beautiful wardrobe, and I've got a chance to look at it. You yourself wear a lot of Indian clothes. You wear kurtas, you wear Nehru jackets. Do you like wearing Indian clothes more than, say, Western clothes? Is it an anti-colonial statement
well,
that you're making?
Yes, and it's compounded by the fact that I spent 29 years in international service at the United Nations, where I had to wear a suit. The first time I wore a kurta, I had a nice, very sort of classy sort of cream or off-white cream silk kurta, khadi, silk khadi kurta. And I go to the office and my doctor says, who do you think you are? And my boss says, who do you think you are, a surgeon? Go back and change. So the next day I came back in a suit and I never got out of suits again for the next 29 years. So as soon as I left the UN, I said, liberation. I'm never going to wear a tie again in India if I can possibly help it. And I almost never have.
You see, historians have debated about this. And people on the internet are still trying to find answers, and there are none. Is it really true, Shashi, that the British, they went to such brutal lengths to cutting off thumbs of weavers of Bengal just to clear their path for, you know, their textile monopoly?
Look, I mean, there are definitely documented incidents of weavers being essentially driven out of business by having their looms, their hand looms, smashed by British soldiers. But this particular episode of the thumbs being cut is controversial. It was recounted by a Dutch trader in Bengal called Robert Bolt, who wrote this in a book published in the 1770s. And certainly it is part of the oral legend of India that this happened. The British deny it, and they claim there is no historical evidence or proof other than the account of an observer who's possibly not a biased observer, because the Dutch were in competition with the British.
But Shashi, the destruction, it wasn't just limited to textile, right? We're talking about something much deeper and much wider. This was about curbing India's traditional medicinal system, also vernacular literature. Yeah. It was an all-out destruction campaign, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, certainly our traditional medicines, namely Ayurveda, a very good example of how the British, first of all, disdained what they call these primitive native forms. But they also wanted to instill in the subject populace the belief that everything British was superior. So they would come and talk about how the only real medicine was their medicine. And that Ayurveda, they sneered at it, they essentially proscribed it, they pushed it away, they banned certain kinds of Ayurvedic preparations and Ayurvedic practices. There's records of their shutting down Ayurvedic clinics. And then this image came about that somehow real medicine was British medicine, and if you couldn't afford British medicine, because it was certainly more expensive than most people could afford, then Ayurveda was for the poor people who couldn't do anything else. And particularly in the rural areas, Ayurveda managed to survive, but no thanks to the British, who would cheerfully have snuffed it out. But their medicines, first of all, didn't reach every village in India. And secondly, most people, especially poor people in the villages, couldn't afford it. So Ayurveda survived and then got revived after independence. The vernacular press, I mean, went through a lot of hassles. What was interesting was that, you know, the British did introduce, if you like, modern newspapers and a free press to India to begin with. But it was not truly free. Even though the first newspapers were all written and published by white men for white readers, because they were in English, the truth is that a couple of English language editors were expelled from India by the East India Company for writing critical things about the company or about British rule. So there was censorship. Then when Indians learned about this technology and started producing newspapers, the British initially didn't take them too seriously. First of all, they couldn't read these Indian languages and understand them. And then they began to realize that the Indian language press was actually far more outspoken against the British, and because far more people who are Indian were reading these papers they were potentially more dangerous for the British than anything that might have been written in the English language press that the British were reading. That's when they passed something called the Vernacular Press Act, and they got very tough. You have to register your paper. If you write anything seditious, which means anything that is liable to excite disaffection, what a word, huh? Disaffection against the British Raj in India, then you would be warned, you could be fined, you could be suspended, your press could be confiscated. That happened to many papers. Their presses were confiscated. And in worst cases, the editors could be banished from the province they were living in that area. It's happened to many others. A famous paper called Swadesh Abhimani in Kerala, whose editor not only had his press confiscated, I mean, the owner had his press confiscated, but the editor was banished from that part of the province in which he lived by the British for writing what was deemed to be seditious. So it was tough. Vernacular literature, on the other hand, the British couldn't do much about unless it was overtly critical of the British. So you did find, for example, hard on the heels of the birth of the novel as a form of writing in Europe and so on, Indians began to imitate. And so the first Indian novels came up in the mid-19th century in Bengali and Malayalam, and people started reading them. But don't forget the British had another weapon, literacy. Because they did nothing to promote literacy in India, the fact is that not that many people could read. It was only a small elite, even in the vernacular languages. So when the British left India in 1947, do you know that our literacy rate was just 16%? And for women, it was even worse, 8.8%. So you put 13 Indian women in a room, only one of them could read.
Everything you're saying is so ironic, simply because, Sashi, a country that supposedly champions free speech today once crushed it in India. And we're not just talking about Vernacular Press Act that you just mentioned, but also instances like burning libraries, for example, in Jhansi. To what extent do you think this censorship basically scarred our languages, our literature, our intellect?
The Jhansi episode, if I remember right, was because when they crushed the revolt of 1857 in 1858 in Jhansi, they burned a lot of buildings, homes and so on, and that the library also got burned, if that's the episode you're referring to. But if you look at the whether the British did that systematically, deliberately, they could probably deny it and say, look, a lot of things got burned in the fighting and so on, and that's what happened. But there have been episodes in which, yes, there was a conscious desire to suppress alternative forms of creativity. The British did have a challenge, though, because in some cases, these alternative forms of creativity flourished outside their formal political control. Remember, the British had two kinds of rule in India. There were places they ruled directly, and there were places they ruled indirectly. That is, they left them under the control of princes, nawabs, maharajas, and until 1858, the Mughal emperor was still there. So Mirza Ghalib flourished, for example, in the Mughal emperor's Delhi. But at the same time, the British made clear that certain limits were not crossed. The famous red lines we talk about today, the British made it very clear there were red lines that could not be crossed, even in these domains where their sort of executive officer was a guy called the Resident, which seems such an innocent title. He's just a resident in a princely state. But he was the most powerful man in the state. He was telling the king, the Maharaja, the Nawab, the Nizam, whoever, what he could do and what he could not do, and what he could permit and not permit. So all of these princes knew which side their bread was buttered or which side their jewels were polished. It was by being absolutely loyal to the British.
Sashi, from banning Ayurvedic practices to now packaging and selling Ayurveda and yoga and Indian spirituality, when did it all become so cool? How did that shift sort of take place?
I think Indians get some credit for that. I think what happened was with Ayurveda, for example, there was this fact that, you know, these medicines, which had been in use for a couple of thousand years, were all derived from natural herbs and organic products and oils and so on that came out of the earth. And as the world itself became more environmentally conscious, more respectful of organic products, more respectful of you know, products connected to the earth and so on, they suddenly realized, gosh, this is good for us. And then they themselves started packaging and manufacturing and selling these things. Ayurvedic massages, kept alive in India, disdained by the British. There's no record of the British doing anything more than having what they call a shampoo. You know, because the imperative verb for having somebody wash your hair was champo, you know, press, knead my hair kind of thing. And that's how the word shampoo came into being. So the British did all of that. Yoga, of course, there isn't a town, for example, in the United States without a yoga center or a yoga class being offered. And increasingly the same is true in Europe as well. Again, simple exercises based on rational scientific principles practiced for 3,000 years in India, suddenly the merit of it is found. And of course, some people have chosen to sort of de-Hinduize yoga in the West, but nonetheless, it is very much our systems of exercise and fitness that have gone to the modern world.
Well, people on the internet are also asking if the Prime Minister of the country, Narendra Modi, is trying to Hinduize yoga.
Well, yoga always emerged from that culture. That it was all part of the entire sort of Hindu way of being, of relating to the world. It was part of how you would... the mind and the body and the soul were all interconnected in ancient Hindu thought. And so it was entirely appropriate to that degree that, for example, yogic practice very often began with breathing exercises and ended with a chant of an Om. Now, you can't say that that isn't a Hindu practice. It is. You might want to argue that you don't want to do that. That's up to you. But the truth is, it's still very much what it is.
Well, there's a curious Redditor who asks, would there still have been an industrial revolution if there was no European colonization? And just how deeply rooted the industrial revolution is in the colonial soil?
Look, the industrial revolution happened to be a product of Western inventions. I mean, let's accept that. Whether it was the power looms, whether it was the steam engine, whether it was the entire panoply of inventions, mainly coming out of England, Germany, and so on in the 19th century, powered the Industrial Revolution, made those countries rich, no doubt about it. Let us argue, for whatever, for theoretical purposes, that India had not been colonized, as your questioner wants to know. What if India hadn't been colonized? It would have been far wealthier, as it was before it was colonized. And that wealthy country would have reached out to some German or some Englishman and said, come and establish a factory here. We would have bought these things. It's not that the Industrial Revolution would somehow have stayed away from India. On the contrary, just as I said, talked to you the other day about how railways came to Thailand and Japan without they ever having to go to the trouble and expense of being colonized, the same would have been true of industries, of factories, of anything else. I mean, that's the way the world is.
How did colonies like, say, Canada, Australia, the United States of America recover so quickly while India, Shashi, is still a developing country?
It's extremely difficult to give you one simple answer to that because there are very many complex factors between one country and another. For example, the US had bountiful land, favorable climate, extremely high fertility, and a relatively modest population, not least because they butchered so many of the original so-called Red Indians and Native American peoples. And so there was a tremendous potential for growth and expansion. And that's largely true of Canada as well. Canada certainly had a harsher climate for much of its territorial expanse. India had other problems. I mean, tropical countries tend to be more prone to certain kinds of diseases and problems like that, which we were treating through our own systems of medicine. When those systems went down, I'm going to give you one example. When under British colonialism, we had the so-called Spanish flu, which had swept the world. The largest human toll was in India, where 5 million, some people say as many as 20 million may have died in the Spanish flu. Our systems of medicine didn't exist to prevent all of this and protect ourselves from it. Though there was Spanish flu and there were victims of Spanish flu in every other country, the others were not so badly off. Then you look at a country like the United States once again, or many of the countries that were settled, not just colonized, but settled by people from Britain, and then from other European countries, they brought with them a lot of the systems of those countries, and they did not suffer the discrimination that peoples who were brown and black suffered under colonial rule. The way in which the rulers were organizing their systems in order to benefit only the white people, that created a problem in, say, India or Africa that didn't exist in, say, America or Australia, because they were essentially all the same people.
Shashi, true or false, the British invented the modern world. Few other countries can match its proud legacy of innovation and invention.
In the 19th century, true. Even early 20th century, true. What is the modern world? It keeps on changing. I mean, I would say for the last 100 years, the Americans have done a lot better than the British, right? And they've invented far more. And certainly pretty much all the modern technologies that we live with today, from the telephone to the computer to the internet, the AI, everything else, these are all American inventions and not British anymore. But the British did have an enormous record in the 19th and early 20th centuries, no doubt about it. They also ruled half the world. As you know, the famous line about the sun never sets on the British Empire. I joked, and it wasn't an entirely original joke, because it goes back 100 years, that the sun never set on the British Empire because even God couldn't trust the English in the dark.
We love that one, don't we? Shashi, again, true or false, the British invented industrial revolution, and with cheap fossil fuels, it led to billions living longer, healthier and happier lives. The world should be grateful to the UK for this contribution.
Look, human progress is human progress, right? Whoever did it. There is no doubt that if you look at any century, right, the people are living longer, people are healthier, people are taller, people are fitter. It's just happened right throughout. I mean, if you go to a museum in Europe of a palace that was built, say, in the 1700s, look at the size of the beds. People were just smaller. Today, everyone is taller. No one fit into any of those beds anymore. So the fact is that the human race, if you want to call them that, have evolved, have grown, and who knows, perhaps in 100 years' time, we will all look rather puny by comparison with the Amazons of that era. Who knows? The truth is, there is change. You can give credit to some for some inventions. You can blame them for other things they did. The truth is, nobody is completely... heroic in all of this, and nobody is completely just villainous. From India's experience of British colonialism, there's almost nothing, as I've said, that we can be grateful for. But let's say if you're from Singapore, which was essentially a rock, yes, it was a trading settlement right along the edges of the coast, but it was a small island with not very much going for it, built up entirely by the British, including with a lot of Indian slave labor and penal colony labor, not slave labor, they were prisoners in the mid-19th century, and then going on thereafter to become a fairly prosperous colony, made much more prosperous after independence by Singaporean rulers. But I'm saying they could probably say, yes, we got our start entirely thanks to the Brits. I don't think the Indians would say it because we'd got our starts when the British were still running around in bearskins.
Shashi, many thanks for, again, enlightening us with all of your knowledge. We'll see you again soon.
See you again. Thanks.
The Empire's cruelty wasn't just economic. It was existential. They dismantled our creativity. Yet here we stand. Scarred, yes, but unbroken, alive, and rebuilding.